When David Ambrose was around 4 years old, he remembers having this thought for the very first time. I think I might die.
From just freezing cold, my sister and brother stopped speaking. We couldn't control our bowel movements, and we started having fuzzy thoughts and collapsing.
It was winter in New York City in the early 1980s. David and his family, his mom, brother, and sister, were homeless.
We sat on top of grates with the subway air pushed out was warm.
I said David was around 4 years old at the time because he's not really sure.
Really interesting thing about time when you're homeless is it's unmarked. And so these normal things like photo albums or school graduations or holidays just kind of come and go.
This is Up First Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin. And today we're thinking about the reality of homelessness through the eyes of David Ambrose. His new memoir is called A Place Called Home. He tells a vivid story of his childhood, his mother's mental illness, abuse, hunger, welfare, the foster care system, and how he overcame all of that. Stay with us. You're listening to Up First Sunday. David Ambrose says he can't remember a time before he and his family were homeless.
I feel like I came into the world in this state and my memories began in motion in places that just blurred public spaces with endless strangers and fear as the kind of white noise of my existence, just a perpetual state of motion, but at the same time, love. My mom and my siblings, we had a dysfunctional but beautiful and profound love for each other.
That dysfunctional love from his mother and the mental illness she lived with is at the core of David's story. It colors everything about his early life.
I think when my mom was, a single mom with three children in poverty, and then layer on top mental illness and all of these systems that trapped us. You know, in order to get rent and benefits, you had to have an address. In order to have an address, you had to have rent. In order to apply for food stamps, you needed a place where you could receive mail. It trapped my mom in the cycle of constant need, constant begging herself from the institutions that are supposed to help families like mine. So that distress was a permanent noise in my mom. She constantly had to figure that out and quite often was not able to, and we had to step in from the earliest age I can remember. My mom was also, you know, mental illness is not something one can predict. And she had various things she struggled with, and you just never knew. It could be a day or a week when she would be in a relatively speaking fugue state, or it could be, you know, hyper. Or it could be a place where what I like to think of as the warrior mom who wanted to care for her family was there. Always too infrequent on that last one, but certainly present. So there was no one trigger, and anything you did might trigger it, and you just did not know. You might do nothing, but at the same time, you knew it was coming.
You and your siblings just had no clue which version of your mom you were going to get on any given day.
Yeah, I think love and family love in particular is a perpetual state of forgiveness, right? Even with families that don't struggle with mental illness. And with my mom, she has for nearly 80 years been in a prison of delusions and fear. And it is worse than anything I could ever imagine or want to have happen to her. And at any single moment, as she made her way through that prison, no one, least of all us, could predict where she'd be. There's certainly moments and triggers that I knew would stress her, that could push her over that edge. So things like being evicted when we did have an apartment very briefly, or moments when she did not have access to cigarettes. We knew that there were certain triggers, but those were, while signposts, they weren't guarantees one way or the other.
There's one moment in particular that illustrates how unpredictable David's mother was and how dangerous that unpredictability could be. She had managed to get a job as a live-in aide for an older woman, and this woman allows the entire family to move in with her. She also happened to be Jewish.
When we lived with this woman, my mom became of the belief that I should become Jewish. And up until this point, my name is actually Hugh. And my mom decided I was going to be converted. And the way that she would do that is through having me circumcised.
Not only is that a dangerous operation for an 8-year-old, but David says the doctor botched it.
And there was no aftercare. And I became severely infected, which nearly killed me. And the woman we live with then began to experience mom and all of her eccentricities and mental illness becoming very clear and evicted us and threw us out onto the streets. And so something that so profoundly touched me, not only the surgery, but also the changing of one's name and then the feeling of being violated so deeply, left a really profound scar in my psyche that through years has stayed with me. And I quite often think about who that other boy was and would have been, Hugh, as opposed to who I am today, who I love, but nonetheless is not my birth name.
How did you even reconcile what was happening at the time? Your mom wasn't Jewish?
I think one thing I've learned, and it honestly is not just my mom, if we're looking for objectivity and rationality in the world that we operate in, it's not going to be present.
Yeah.
It's not there. And you yourself will go insane trying to look for it. My mom, through her illness, taught me that. And the situation we're in was a constant state of, you're not going to understand it, but you got to figure it out pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was not something I sought to do. I knew that I had to survive the moment. I knew that I had to take care of myself. I knew that no one else would.
Yeah. From time to time, she would enroll you in school. She would get an apartment for a couple of months, and you would feel this false sense of security. What was school like?
School was everything. I think schools today and even then have become so much more than a place where we learn. They are a place where kids are fed, where we access healthcare, and we're cool or we're warm, we're safe. And there's this idyllic idea of what childhood should be, at least present in those hours of the day. I loved school. School was, I would live for that free lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers saw what was going on and did just a little bit more to help my siblings and I get through the day or the moment. I remember so many times that I had lice, and we would go to the school nurse office to deal with that, and to have someone in a compassionate way wash your hair and be touched in a nonviolent way is such a beautiful and intimate thing. And I felt that while I was getting my hair washed with, if you've ever had lice, y'all, or you had a kid that has.
I've had it.
Yeah,
my kids have had it.
It's not an intimate moment, but to be touched by an adult in a moment like that is profound. And to have teachers sneak snack bars into your bag, my bodega plastic bag, which was my school bag, to have them know that that's all that I would eat. They would sneak it in my bag. And I knew that. And they spent that extra time with me. So two infrequent, but really profound moments of grace that I discovered in schools.
Your mom's abuse got worse over time. Your older brother finally ran away. I mean, you all plotted it together. But he was the one who got out first. I know it was a joint plan, but did you still feel, abandoned by him?
No. If you have a sibling or a child, they're your whole world. And my mom abused all of us, and we were all suffering from the neglect. And to see my brother harmed and nearly killed, you're going to do everything you can to get that person to safety, no matter what it costs you.
Mm.
And I knew that my brother, in my heart at the time, I felt like he was more fragile than me. I could take more of this than my brother could. And so we conspired and stole a bike and had the brilliant idea of having him take a bike from Western Massachusetts back to New York, where he would take up with one of our former neighbors who happened to have been a prostitute, who would take him in. And that was our idea. That's the moment of desperation we were in. And by the way, he made it, just so we are all clear.
Yeah.
My brother made it.
You finally decide that you have to leave. She, in a moment of eruption, of anger, of desperation, lashes out at you. And you, I mean, as you write in the book, you're almost at death's door. I mean, you drag yourself to an ER and you finally say, it's my mom who's done this.
Yeah. I mean, I think about the moments in my life where I've had to come out and I use that word very thoughtfully, but this is one of those moments when I knew that to protect her was to die, that to protect her was that we would die. And I had to take us out of that situation. And so despite efforts in the past, this was the moment of rupture when I truly, in my heart and mind, became a man, an adult, and I knew that I could not save her, that we had to save ourselves. And the system, although it works slowly, does grind forward. And that's when we entered that whole world of state custody for good.
When we return, David talks about this new life in foster care and the uncertainty and abuse he found there. Welcome back to Up First Sunday. David Ambrose was 12 when he and his brother and sister realized they weren't going to survive a life with their mother on the streets. So they willingly entered the world of child protective services. And with it came this feeling of profound relief.
I thought we were saved. I thought, this is it. We finally did it. And my brother and sister and I are going to be okay.
That feeling didn't last long, though.
It was maybe days before I was placed in a very dangerous situation with young criminal offenders where I did not belong, and experienced my first assaults in foster care and detention.
Your social worker, therapists, all these people who are intervening in these moments, at that moment, seemed to understand your sexual identity before you did. And you suffered a lot because of what was clear was a built-in homophobia into the system. I mean, people are thinking through, without saying it, we've got to be very sensitive to where we put you because you're gay, but we're not going to say that out loud.
Yeah, you know, even today, there are double the percentage that we are in the population is represented in foster care. There are 18 to 20% of foster kids are queer. When I went into the system, it was not only not spoken about, it was something you treated. And I went through that.
Conversion therapy. People thought it was a problem that needed to be fixed.
Right from my first residential foster home, they diagnosed me as gay, and the foster parents, the therapist, and the system went to work to help me be not gay. Emotional abuse, rules that were capricious and reversing and shaming me for being an adolescent.
Not only was David shamed for his identity, but he also experienced the same physical deprivation that he endured on the streets.
I think we think of hunger as the thing that it can be contained. But hunger is a cancerous, metastasizing thing. When you're hungry, you can barely misbehave. You can't think, and you certainly can't talk back. So hunger can be wielded as a weapon. And the other part is food and our body images, especially as adolescents, are so potent as tools, as we all learned, you know, with the discussion about social media and how young people think of themselves physically. And it can be weaponized both to subdue and control and to torture with mentally. And that certainly was the case in my time there. think the people that I write about deserve condemnation, but all of us should ask ourselves, what are we doing? Because the people I write about should not be foster parents, some of them. However, the more pernicious part is all the adults that I walked amongst that do nothing, that let these people foster, that let the condition of hundreds of thousands of children every single day experience that. They were horrendous. They were horrendous people. They had no capacity to do the task that they were asked to do, but we're underfunding a system. Not enough people are stepping up to foster. And what do we expect to have happen?
After moving through a series of dysfunctional and abusive homes like this, David was eventually placed with loving caretakers. He went on to go to Vassar on a scholarship. He interned at the White House under President Bill Clinton and went to law school. Today, he lives in Los Angeles, where he works for Amazon as head of community engagement for the western part of the country.
Can I ask about your life now for a minute?
I have the best life. I'm so happy. I'm in a home that I own. I have a beautiful foster son who's in graduate school.
Oh, you do.
My brother and sister are thriving with advanced degrees and beautiful, healthy families. I care for my mom. She's still no longer homeless, but she's still, you know, fighting her demons.
Yeah.
But I care for her, and I'm a active member of my community, and I kind of have the best damn job you could possibly imagine. I'm literally charged with doing good in the community by Amazon, where I work. They want me to go out and do good in the community using our resources, and I think about that every day. How could this kid that lived in Grand Central go out today with the resources of this company and try and change lives? And literally my measurement of my success is that impact. How is that possible? And that's why I remain optimistic.
You, as a kid, had to develop these incredible survival instincts and strategies to stay safe, to stay alive. Do those still kick in from time to time?
I think about my life in two or three periods, but one of the most profound changes came in my late 30s when I started crying randomly. And this is after 20-something years of no tears, not once. And what I realized was all of the way that I'd cope with the world was to take these assaults, physical, verbal, whatever, and put them in a clear plastic box and put them on a shelf and label them and then put them in my card catalog. I knew exactly where they were. I did not deny them, but I didn't have to feel them. In my 30s, the shelf broke and the stuff came tumbling off and I had to deal with them. And then I also had to figure out a new way to interact with the world because my coping mechanism was gone. Those experiences are still with me and they do affect me. Foster kids have a higher rate of PTSD than veterans. Let that sink in.
Yeah.
It's insane. And yet it's true. To this day, I have those moments when I will jolt awake with a particular hard memory. And you just tell yourself, A, you're safe, and B, you're going to do something about that. And so you do it, and you get up every day, and you think about the kids that are in the system today, or the homeless kids that I drive by every single day. And we've got to do better. And that's what helps me get through my days, is to think, gosh, that fear or that horrible memory, I can do something.
Did you ever think about changing your name back to Hugh, especially considering how the name David was bestowed to you in that kind of violent way?
Yeah, you know, as you have the book, there's a dedication section, and then there's the acknowledgments. There's one of the people listed in the acknowledgments is HJDA, Hugh John David Ambrose.
I missed
and
that.
I listed the acronym because I do think about that boy. I think about who he would have been if he was in a different world. And I don't mourn him because I love who I am and who I become. I love David Ambrose, not as a name, but who I've made that mean something. Mm-hmm. That means something. And it means something because of the life that I lead and the work that I've done and will do. I fully embrace my name. Do I think about that individual? Absolutely. Names and words have power. And I've learned that particularly of late. Pronouns, these things matter. But I am David Ambrose, and that is a name that I own and I have built and I have made mean something both to myself and my community.
The book is called A Place Called Home. We've been talking with David Ambrose. David, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
This episode of Up First Sunday was produced by Lee Hale. It was edited by Jenny Schmidt and Simone Popperl. Our supervising producer is Leanna Simstrom. We'll be back tomorrow with all the news you need to start your week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.